Hello everyone and welcome to this Institute for Government event on what to watch out for in the local elections. I'm Emma Norris, I'm the Deputy Director here. So tomorrow voters across England and Wales are going to be heading to the polls. Up for election are 10 metro mayors, close to 3,000 local councillors, 37 police and crime commissioners, and then the 25 members of the London Assembly. And there's also the parliamentary by-election in Blackpool South. Now, lots of people are going to be watching these elections for clues as to what we might expect in the general election that will be happening later this year or early next. But these elections' importance goes far beyond that. The 10 mayors that are up for election are influential regional figureheads in their own right. They have some of the largest political mandates of any politician in the country. And together, the mayors will be responsible for about £25 billion worth of public spending. They'll play a vital role, and indeed do already play a vital role, in securing the futures of the areas they represent. Now, as the results of tomorrow's election start to roll in, I think all eyes are going to be on what happens to Conservative incumbents Andy Street in the West Midlands and Ben Houchen in Tees Valley, looking at whether they'll be able to hold on to their seats. And then in the North East, the incumbent North of Tyne Mayor, Jamie Driscoll's obviously running as an independent, having been blocked from the Labour Party shortlist. But just as important are the local elections that are going on. There are going to be lots of new councillors taking on responsibility for key public services at a time of acute financial pressure in local government. And then we'll see whether Labour can convert its high opinion poll leads in councils to wins in places like Bolton, Stockport, Southend and so on. So to talk about all of that, I'm delighted to have a brilliant panel with me. We've got the editor of the Local Government Chronicle, Sarah Culkin, the polling expert, Sir John Curtis, who's a professor of politics at Strathclyde University and a senior research fellow at the National Centre for Social Research, and of course, a podcaster like everybody else these days, and the Institute for Government's Programme Director for Devolution, Akash Pound. So we're going to start with some opening questions for the panel. We'll probably talk amongst ourselves for about 20 minutes, then I'll save about half an hour from questions from the audience. And for those of you that are joining us online, hello, you can start asking questions right now by submitting them via Slido. I'll make sure that when it comes to questions, I take a mix from the room and from people online. Okay, so without further ado, John, I'm going to come to you first. What do the polls say is likely to happen across these elections, and which contests should we be watching most closely?
Well, of course, strictly speaking, with the exception of some of the Metro mayors and the London mayoral contest, the answer is the polls say nothing because we've not had any polls of local election voting behaviour. And the truth, because of the very idiosyncratic nature of the cycle of local elections in England, it is pretty much impossible to do. Occasionally people try to do it, but it's, which bits of England have an election in any particular year is, it's almost worth a PhD in itself. So that's the first answer to you. Then let me give you a second answer. Of course, the circumstances in which these elections are being held are very, very different from the circumstances in which most, though not all, of the positions being contested this time were last contested. So basically, of course, all the mayoral and PCC contests and the London Assembly contests were last fought over in May 2021, which was a postponed election from 2020 in the pandemic. In the case of the local elections, there's only about 70% of the seats are up from 2021 because of ward boundary changes. And if you get ward boundary changes, all of a sudden everybody's seats are up for grabs, and therefore, so you've got seats that were elected in 22 and 23 in there as well. Anyway, it might now be difficult to remember, but 3 years ago, Boris Johnson, remember him? He was Prime Minister. And not only that, he was ahead in the opinion polls. On average, the Conservatives were 6 points ahead. This was not long after the COVID vaccine rollout, which is probably the biggest PR success of the Conservative administration under Boris Johnson. And Sir Keir's leadership, the Labour Party, was a little bit uncertain this time. Now, of course, the Conservatives are 20 points behind in the opinion polls. Their position in the polls, indeed, is weaker now than it was when Liz Truss vacated 10 Downing Street. So, therefore, inevitably, the speculation so far as, what does this mean in terms of where we are politically, is all about how much will the Conservatives lose and will the local ballot boxes affirm or not the message of the opinion polls. Now, at that point, let me just stop. We know that not everybody votes in local elections in the same way as they do in a general election. About one in five don't. 2021 BES shows that very clearly. And in particular, the Liberal Democrats always do better in local elections than they do in the contemporaneous opinion polls. And that's now also of the Greens, and independents have had a bit of a revival as well. So to that extent, at least, you certainly can't just simply read the result of the general election off this. In any case, any ballot simply tells you about where you are now. It doesn't necessarily tell you where you will be in 6 months' time, okay? So I think the way to think of this in terms of the framing of the kind of significance of Westminster is, does it mean the Tories are bound to lose? But rather, does it affirm the message of the opinion polls that the position of the Conservative Party may be even weaker now than it was 12 months ago, and that perhaps Labour's lead over the Conservatives may have strengthened somewhat, although that's not so clear from the opinion polls. So that's what I think, broadly speaking, we are looking for. Now, at that point, one has to say there are certain contests that we should probably not take too much notice of, but of which journalists are being encouraged to take a great deal of notice by the Conservative Party in particular. And that here, those in particular are the contests in Tees Valley and in the West Midlands. Of course, the Conservative Party is kind of hoping that Andy Street and or Ben Houchin will win one of those two contests, and they will be able to say, well, look, the opinion polls to say we're 20 points behind, but look, we're still winning contests that we won 3 years ago. The polls are wrong. This will be nonsense, all right? First of all, and this is something to look out for, there are two elections in the West Midlands conurbation tomorrow. There is one for the mayor and there is one for the Police and Crime Commissioner. An election that the government tried to stop, but the High Court stopped them from aligning the PCC with the morality because there hadn't been enough consultation. While Andy Street won the morality in 2021, Labour won the PCC election, right? So that's already a first clue that maybe Mr. Street has a not insignificant personal vote. And that, of course, is one of the things that Metro mayors are meant to be able to do. You know, Ben Houchin getting 72% of the vote in Tees Valley in 2001 was a superb personal performance. But really, really valuably, so the first thing you can do, we'll be able to compare Andy Street's vote with what happens in the PCC election. That's clue number one. And then the second thing we know from the opinion polling done by Redfield and Wilton in both Tees Valley and in West Midlands, that ask people how they would vote in a general election, and the Labour Party is well ahead in both places, all right? And there are quite a lot of people who, if you look at the innards of the polling there, go, I'm not going to vote for the Conservatives, couldn't possibly vote for them, but yeah, I'll vote. You know, they voted Conservative in 2019, and they're not so unhappy that they aren't willing to vote for Andy Street because they think he's quite a good guy and quite a good mayor and all the rest of it. So in other words, because of the personal votes of these two, this is going to be the least reliable indicator. Whereas, you know, the elections for the councillor of whom nobody has ever heard of in Tunbridge West or wherever is going to be a much more reliable guy because these persons, for the most part, will have less in the way of a personal appeal, okay? But, you know, the Conservative Party is doing this because they think they might manage to win the contest, and therefore they'll be able to cover whatever disasters happen elsewhere. I mean, equally, conversely, here in London, Sadiq Khan will not do as well as the Labour Party would do in a general election because Sadiq Khan has a negative personal vote, okay? But this city is now so strongly Labour and he's going to win anyway. So the Metro mayors are the contests you should not look at. But they are the ones in which journalists are hooked because it's got big personalities, the people they've heard of, and they can write a human interest story around it. But in terms of the boring sophology that people like me are interested in, we're going, no, don't bother, don't take any notice. This isn't actually a guide for insofar as you want to find out what these local elections and how people vote in these local elections tell us about where we are politically across the country as a whole.
thank you, John, particularly for debunking some of the debate that's going on at the moment.
Well, it's called getting in the anti-spin in before the spin,
right? So, Sarah, if John set out some of what we should be looking for and some of what we should be ignoring, perhaps you can tell us a bit about why the local elections and indeed the mayoral elections matter. What is at stake tomorrow?
Yeah, well, the sort of short answer, as you alluded to, is councils have direct control over around £64 billion of public money, which is not insignificant. I think the mayor's figure is about £25 billion, and that's not even the whole of it because they have influence over a lot more spending. They also deliver services, some of which we will all use and rely on every day. They maintain parks, they keep our streets clean, obviously collect the bins, but also those services that we might turn to in times of need, so housing, social care, things like that. So, in short, you're going to want somebody competent and capable taking decisions about that, all that kind of spending. But at least as important, I would say, and certainly I think councils feel this, is their role as stewards of the places that we all call home. So that would be through things like decisions on planning, on capital investment, but also just as advocates for their places nationally, and in the case of the mayoral combined authorities, even internationally, in terms of attracting investment, working with business. None of the councils I know kind of look at their list of statutory services and then just go out and deliver the bare minimum. If something's going on in their place, they want to get involved in it. They very much see themselves as sort of leaders of place. And I think the same is true of metro mayors, who many will say on paper they haven't got that much power. But I think what we've seen is that they haven't let that kind of limit their ambition or what they want to get involved with at home. So a good example of that might be Andy Street and Andy Burnham and what they've done around homelessness, which is not their remit at all. Mm. I think it's been quite interesting, someone who's been covering local government for almost 10 years now, to see in the last 18 months the sort of national attention that local government and councils have been getting. Now, that's not really for good reasons. It's linked to the many sort of Section 114 notices we've seen declared, with councils saying they can't balance their books. But while it hasn't been for good reasons, it has actually shone a spotlight on the significance of local government and the fact that what they do goes a lot, you know, way beyond just collecting the bins, not fundamentally important as that is. Don't want to diminish that. I think, so of those councils where we have seen them declare 114 notices, only a couple of them actually have elections this time, in Woking and Thurrock, and they've already been to the polls. But we did see some evidence last year that voters in those places were sort of punishing the administrations that had got the council into trouble. And so, to John's point, that's sort of some local issues at play. So in Slough, for example, Labour lost control of the council, which massively bucked the national trend last year when the Conservatives lost over 1,000 seats. I think the other thing that makes local elections different and is important is they're kind of the front line of local democracy and where communities sort of most connect with democracy. And I think what that trend we've seen in recent years of a greater number of candidates from smaller parties and independents, and particularly these kind of increasingly sort of place-based groups. So one town in the borough might have a handful of councillors formed a party dedicated to getting the best for that town. We've seen that kind of as an increasing trend. Is really important in terms of building that trust in democracy that perhaps we've seen lost in recent years. And I think I was going to mention the PCCs just because I think it's interesting to look at those roles, and that even though they've been around longer than the metro mayors, they've not achieved anything like the profile, and I think that kind of raises a bit of questions around whether people understand them. But what it does mean is that you, wherever you live tomorrow, you can, in England, you can vote. So please do.
And Wales.
And Wales. Yes, correct. Don't forget Wales.
And Sarah, I just wanted to pick up on something John was saying, that in the West Midlands, for instance, there's an argument that there's a big personal vote for Andy Strozzi rather than necessarily being party aligned. In your experience, and you know, based on kind of the conversations you have, what determines how people are casting their votes in these polls? Is it about the national politics, or is it about how politicians have performed locally?
I think it's a real mixed bag, isn't it? It very much depends on what profile those individuals have and or what profile the local issues had. So, for example, you know, the example of Slough, where the Labour did lose control because the local populations blamed them for some of the things that had happened there in terms of all the excessive borrowing and things. So I think it's hard to say. I don't think you can say it's a uniform picture. It very much depends on the local area and, you know, to a certain extent, the role of local media and how active they are in terms of reporting this stuff and making people aware of it, which, as we know, is pretty patchy in some places these days.
Thanks. And Akash, let's just talk a bit more about the 10 Metro mayors who are up tomorrow. So how important have Metro mayors become, and what impact have they actually had at the local and perhaps the national level too?
So I think increasingly important, and that's both in terms of what Sarah and John have already spoken about, their high name recognition, that big personal mandate they have from being directly elected across a region, and the ability and authority that gives them to act as champions for their places, as you said, Sarah, in negotiating with government and negotiating with businesses to invest in the region, and giving a voice to places that in many places have, you know, long felt, in many cases have long felt left out of national debates. I think that's partly what Ben Houchen has been so successful at, Tees Valley. You know, even when there's a focus on, say, North-South divide, Northern powerhouse strategy and so on, Tees Valley, I think, is one of the bits that typically feels a bit ignored and left out, and Ben Houchen's really been able to correct that and has a record of delivery, albeit there's, you know, some controversy surrounding some of the stuff he's done, but there's very specific, concrete stuff he can point to in terms of jobs that he's, you know, associated with creating, investment he's brought in, favours done to for him by government too, which is maybe partly for party political reasons, but still, he's the mayor who can stand up and say, I got the Freeport, I got, you know, government to set up its treasury campus in Darlington, that kind of thing. So it is that sort of champion voice role, but it's not just that. I mean, mayors started off at the point of creation fairly weak, in many respects, but the devolution process has continued, and at this point, I mean, you've already mentioned the kind of size of the budgets collectively Metro mayors control. This is not insignificant amounts of money, and they are taking important decisions over transport, over housing, over planning, regeneration, in some cases policing, health, things like that as well. And I think we can start to see, we have started to see the actual impact of the decisions they have taken. I mean, transport is, you know, the biggest devolved function if you look at the budgets, and it is kind of at the core of a lot of the mayor's strategies, regional economic strategies. So, you know, there's absolute direct evidence of what mayors can do. Andy Burnham's taken the buses into public control, prioritised, you know, improving connectivity between the city centre, where jobs are, education opportunities and so on are, and some of the surrounding boroughs like Oldham and Bolton that are more deprived and have, you know, lacked the ability, or people living there have lacked the ability to access those opportunities. So I think that's the type of thing that really makes the case for devolution to that scale. A leader and an institution, because it's not just the mayor themselves, it's the combined authority, able to think in a joined up way about transport, about housing, about skills and so on. So I think that's the kind of area you've seen kind of quite clear benefits coming through. I think also in sort of skills system, the actual fruits of that, to some extent, we won't see for some time to come, because you know, ultimately this is about improving productivity and economic growth, and, you know, maybe come back in 5-10 years and we'll see whether you can see those growth trajectories converging, which is the idea. But you can already see how, say, in West Midlands, there's been a real big attempt to, for example, prioritise higher like level 3+ qualifications, because on average the population there has lower skills and there's a big demand from sort of manufacturing sector and that kind of thing. So those are the kind of decisions I do think Metro mayors are very well placed to take. And yeah, for me, I think for those reasons, Andy Street and Ben Houch and those races are the ones I will be interested in watching. Not as John said, because they'll tell us much about the national situation, but because there'll be a real test of whether the mayoral system has taken root, and voters are judging mayors and candidates on their record and on their vision for the place.
Mm-hmm. And on that, John, I wonder if people, you know, agree that mayors really are making a difference and that this is the stuff that kind of affects their lives, what might we see happen to turnout tomorrow? Should we expect turnout to be high? And if it's not, if turnout is low, does that matter?
Well, I mean, the one place where we've got, as we're a bit of a historical record in terms of mayors in particular, is London. And sorry, it's a while since I've looked at this, but my memory, I mean, and of course in London also you can do a nice comparison with the turnout in the London borough elections. Mm. And my memory is that basically initially turnout for the mayoral contest was simply on a par with those London borough elections, but that more recently the mayoral election has managed to attract a somewhat higher turnout. That said, I mean, I think one has to say that the visibility of the Metro Mayors does vary. I mean, I think, what is it, the Mayor for the West of England? I'm not sure many people know who that is, or Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. And that, broadly speaking, I'm not sure that... Well, I think, I think the jury is out as to whether or not, across the piece, Metro Mayors are going to produce a higher turnout than general. And certainly, if you look at the opinion polls, I mean, there are, for every Andy Burnham, there are quite a few Metro Mayors where the pollsters just basically struggle. I mean, the pollsters saying at the moment, if you're doing this Metro Mayor place, it's very difficult to do because lots of people don't know who we're talking about, right? So that visibility is arguably still certainly an issue there. More broadly, I mean, turnout in local elections in England tends not to be that high. It's typically around 33%. Whether it's going to be markedly different from that this time, who knows? That is very, very difficult to tell. The one institution that really does struggle on the turnout front is the PCCs. Mm-hmm. Remember the first ones that were held, I forgot what the turnout was now. What was it, 12, 13, 40% or whatever it was? It's very, very low.
It was in November or something.
It was held on the... So the first ones they held in November are entirely separate from the local elections. And then they went, basically nobody's turned up. So they then started coupling them with local elections. But then you could still see, because there are always some places, because of the rather idiosyncratic character of timing of local elections in England, there were always some places where there wasn't a local election. And even that was even true in 2021. And you can see in those that the turnout tends to be lower, although still somewhat better than November 2016. The challenge in Wales this time, for example, is that both the two previous elections coincided with local or devolved elections in Wales. There's nothing else going on in Wales tomorrow apart from the PCC. And indeed, there are more places in England without coincident local elections, because this is a relatively small part of the cycle, than was the case back in 2021, where they coincided with an enormous double-year cycle. So I think, you know, the PCCs are the one where their merit... turnout in local government elections in England is not brilliant. You see, and the truth is that the PCCs have problems on top of that. And how many of the Metro Mayor contests will actually register anything significantly better, we'll have to see.
Akash, Metro Mayors are such important figures in driving forward this kind of new era of regionalism and heightened kind of regional power. If turnout is very low tomorrow for Metro Mayors, does that raise any questions about legitimacy around this kind of push forward?
But again, we have to be careful, you see, again, because you have to remember a lot of the Metro Mayor contests are occurring alongside local elections, which makes it very, very difficult to disentangle what's going on.
Yeah.
The point about London is you can disentangle because the borough elections always take place at a different time from the mayoral election.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so I think the answer in general is it does matter because, I mean, for the reasons we've talked about already, the effectiveness of these mayors to some extent rests on their ability to claim that strong mandate and the ability to speak for their region. So low turnout indicates lower voter engagement, a weaker mandate for whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. So, I mean, short answer, it does matter. I mean, the other thing I was just gonna note, I mean, we looked at this, just the data on mayoral turnout, and yes, you of course need to look at, which we didn't do, like which other elections were going on the same date. But the general pattern is turnout has increased in all the mayoral elections from the first to the subsequent ones where there's been more than one. I mean, so you mentioned London, John. I mean, yeah, initially it was sort of low 30s. The last one was sort of low 40s. So yeah. Still not spectacular, yeah. Still quite a bit below Scotland, Wales, obviously general elections, but moving in that direction. And the same positive trend was seen in like all the other places where, as I say, we've had two. So, I mean, Tees Valley, it went from 22 or something to 33 or something. We'll see in a couple of days.
Yeah, but again, you have to remember 2021 was an enormously bumper year of local elections because of the postponement of the 2020 elections. So you've got more in the way of stimulation from what's going on in local government.
And of course,
even this year, because most of the metropolitan districts have elections every year, a lot of the mayoral contests are taking place alongside local elections that are going place in either all or most of the combined authority area.
Yeah, some are, yeah.
And Sarah, we've been talking a lot about metro mayors, but I wanted to ask about the newly elected councillors tomorrow. They're, as you said, already facing some really difficult financial pressures. So what are the kind of biggest challenges associated with that they're going to have on their plates?
Yeah, I mean, there is a bit of a who would be a councillor at the moment. You know, nobody goes into politics to make things worse, and some of the decisions that councils are being faced with are really, really difficult about, you know, rationing services or, you know, choosing. Often it's about sort of making sure the money is available for those what we call statutory services, so the adult social care or for children with special educational needs, at the expense of some of the more discretionary services that are actually experienced by more people, and that is really tough. I just want to say something as well about turnout, and John's been referencing this sort of the complicated, idiosyncratic nature of council elections, and that's because of this thing of elections by thirds, where you have, elections in 3 years out of every four and a third of councillors up every year. And it's arguable that that's not really very good for democratic engagement because it means at one end of the scale you don't really get much change. So I think in Wakefield and Sandwell, even if Labour lost all of the councillors all of the seats that are being contested, they wouldn't lose control of the council because there's only a third of them up and their majority is such. And so we kind of saw that a bit in Thurrock last year. The leader lost his seat and the Conservatives' majority was reduced, but they did hold on. So that will be one to watch because Labour are hoping to gain control of that one. Yeah. But Thurrock's also an example of, at the other end of the scale of that, if you've got councils where political control is really finely balanced, then actually it's very difficult to get anything meaningful done because you've essentially got 9 months, and then you're in election mode again, and then the politicians in charge could change, and so for the priorities and the policies, so it can make it very challenging to operate in that environment. And I think this, you know, when you speak to council officers, I don't know any council officers who would advocate for continuing with thirds. Everyone would prefer the sort of all out every 4 years and then, you know, get on and deliver on your sort of manifesto and policy platform.
But the trouble is that does produce incredibly disproportional results because you're using multi-member plurality. As the London boroughs do, so you can get overall majorities on quite small shares of the vote. So that's the dance. I mean, I think if you're going to go down that track, then I think you'd have to think about going back to much smaller wards and having single member wards, because multi member plurality is an even more disproportional system than a single member plurality. Or we can introduce a single transferable vote into English local government in the way that it's already being introduced in Wales and in Scotland. I mean, that's the alternative.
Yeah, although, yeah. Which is arguably more representative, but you get basically all coalitions then, don't you?
Yeah, but the truth is local government in England, as you've already acknowledged, already generates lots of places mm-hmm. with no overall control. It's something like half the councils that are being elected on tomorrow are places where at the moment no single party has overall control.
Mm. I think smaller wards with all-out elections is a better solution, because then you would have much more local community representatives at a sub-ward level.
Yeah, but then the council officers will say, well, all they're then interested in is their own narrow backyard rather than the broader interests of the district as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this long-standing debate about what's the best form of representation.
Just before we go out to the audience, we haven't talked much about the kind of policy questions that are being discussed in these set of elections. Akash, what have some of the kind of big issues been in the mayoral campaigns, and have you seen any particularly interesting policy proposals?
I think there's quite a lot, actually. I mean, first of all, in terms of, you know, issues in the campaign, in eight out of the 10 contests, there's an incumbent mm-hmm. standing. Obviously, the two completely new mayoralties can't have an incumbent. So, you know, all of them are to some extent standing on their record. In some cases, the opposing candidates are trying to focus on the mayor's record. Crime in London, for example, Susan Hall has been talking about that a lot. So, you know, that's part of it. But in terms of sort of new ideas and proposals, there's quite a lot. I mean, transport, as I said, is really the biggest, the kind of big devolved function. And a lot of the candidates are trying to follow that Greater Manchester mm-hmm. or indeed the London TfL model. It's a big priority for Steve Rotherham in Liverpool City Region, for Kim McGuinness in the North East, Tracy Braben in West Yorkshire in a different form. They're all talking about that more integrated transport system with buses taken under public control, multimodal ticketing, all that kind of stuff, as well as, you know, sort of specific schemes that they're committing to investing in. So mass transit scheme in West Yorkshire is a big one, extension of trams in West Midlands, for example. So there's lots of things like that, sort of specific projects. But then also, I mean, just quickly, one of the things that I do find interesting is the extent to which some of the candidates, more than others, are really trying to look beyond and branch out in terms of their vision beyond those kind of core growth, investment, mm-hmm. productivity things, which are kind of at the core of the Devo deals if you look at them on paper. I mean, that's most obvious, and fairly the case with Andy Burnham, I'd say. I mean, he's got these three big ideas he talks about in his manifesto, which are all more kind of like social policy type of things around community health and technical education for like post 16, what he's talking about, an MBAC, Manchester mm-hmm. Baccalaureate. And helping people with like multiple complex needs. So he's really trying to make that broader, and some of the others as well, that broader case for devolved leadership of a wider social policy agenda. And then the other thing I'd note just quickly is lots and lots of the manifestos have proposals and calls for further devolution. I mean, that's very, very strongly present in a lot of...
They want more power. I mean, why you should be surprised?
Well, I'm not surprised, but I think what it does reflect is the fact that both parties in the general election are committed to more devolution, to deeper devolution, to new deals.
But you know as I do, once they get into office, the enthusiasm for devolution strangely begins to diminish.
Well, that's one cynical view, but I mean, a lot of progress has been made over the past 5 years, is what I would say. So a lot of them, they want control of apprenticeships, levy funding, employment support, mm-hmm. power to introduce rent controls, a bunch of other stuff. So there's lots and lots of interesting ideas out there. No, I'm not expecting all of it to happen, John, but I think there's a bit of an opportunity there for mayors, and the IFG has proposals, mm-hmm. quick plug, coming out in a couple of weeks in this space as well.
Sarah, you were going to come in?
Yeah, so I've just been really interested to see how much the mayoral focus is around housing. So the delivery of new homes is part of their core powers, but they're also looking to do stuff on the sort of private rented sector in some cases. Andy Burnham's got proposals around that, Kim McGuinness and Jamie Driscoll as well, I think, which is not their remit. They're talking about retrofit, they're talking about the homes they do build being net zero as far as possible. And I think, you know, housing is such a huge issue in the country at the moment. It seems to be nowhere in our national debate, where we've spent the past however long talking about sending people to Rwanda or not. I think it's actually really refreshing to see some of these issues that are really impacting people's lives day to day kind of getting that airtime and getting that discussion.
Yeah.
And, yeah, to John's point, they all say it in opposition and then they don't. But I guess the difference this time might be there really is no money, and so maybe they will have to try and do something different.
Passing the pain, as we know, is something that central government is very, very keen on.
Yeah.
On that note, I'm going to go out to the audience. And so there'll be mics coming round. I'll probably take questions in groups of three. If you could tell us your name, kind of which organisation or where you're from. I've got a gentleman at the back in the blue shirt there, somebody in yellow here, and somebody in a white T-shirt over here.
Thank you. Alan Evans. I think this question's probably for John, because it's a boring cephalogical question rather than about Metro Mayors. But looking at the local election results tomorrow, to what extent, John, do you think it will be possible to produce a meaningful national projected vote share looking ahead to the general election? And if so, and taking into account that Scotland won't vote, which will be vital to the election, what should we be looking for? What would be good for the Conservatives or bad for the Conservatives? Okay. Would it be anything under 20% lead?
Okay.
I'll just take a few more first.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, sure, right, okay, right, oops.
Hi, Philippe Lefebvre, here in a personal capacity. I want to ask a question about voter ID. This is not the first election of voter ID laws, but it is coming up a lot. And obviously, we couldn't really draw many conclusions last year about the impact. Will we be able to, do you think, more so tomorrow, about effects on turnout or effects on anything related to the elections upcoming? Thank you.
Thank you. And then one over here.
Matthew Price from Delta Poll. Another question, probably mainly for John. One of the main stories from the national polling over the last year is the rise in support for reform, but they're obviously not standing as many candidates as the other parties in the local elections tomorrow. So I was wondering what you think will be the best gauge that we'll get from tomorrow for whether that support is translating.
Yeah. Okay, so national vote share projections, reform. John, I'll come to you on those.
Okay, well, Alan, I hope it's going to be possible to produce a meaningful quote-unquote projected national share, because I'm contracted to do so by Friday afternoon. But straight away I'm going to say to you, it is not even telling you, even attempting to tell you what the result of a general election would be if it was held tomorrow, let alone what it might be in 6 months' time. It is a measure of the local electoral performance of the parties, and it should be compared with the local electoral performance in previous years of the parties. That's the way to think of it. It's a measure of where we are now through the rather complicated prism of the cycle of English local government elections. But that be underneath that, there are things to look out for. And I'll, at this point, I'll link it with the third question. Those of us who've been doing this for far too long will know that two of the crucial signals that came from the local elections of 1995 and 1996 were, one, that the Conservatives were losing ground more heavily in places where they were previously strongest, and two, that voters were voting tactically against the Conservatives on an unprecedented scale. Both of those geographical patterns then manifested themselves in the 1997 general election. Last year's local elections, For the first time since the formation of the coalition in 2010, saw a significant amount of anti-Conservative tactical voting. And secondly, it very definitely showed the Conservative losing votes more heavily in places where they're previously strongest. That's why the Tories ended up losing 1,000 seats, right? So those are two things that underneath the bonnet of the projected national share, I'm definitely on the lookout for. And of course, one of the reasons why the MRP polling that we've had that's done a lot of publicity of the, do you really mean to think the Tories can get less than 100 seats? Well, maybe, is because of the risk because that, while those polls are picking up, they don't pick up the tactical voting. Polls won't pick up tactical voting at this stage. But they are picking up that tendency for the Tories to lose votes more heavily in places where they're previously strongest, which in part is almost an arithmetical inevitability, because at the moment the Conservatives on average are 22 points down on where they were in 2019. And there's about 100 constituencies where they did not get 22% of the vote in 2019. Ergo, their vote must be going down more elsewhere, right? Okay, that takes me to reform. I mean, you're right, and I think one of the reasons why the Conservatives may not do as badly as some people are anticipating is because reform are only fighting one in six of the local government wards. They're only fighting, what, a couple of the metro mayors, a couple of the PCCs. They're fighting fewer than they did in 2021. Though for some strange reason, they're fighting the elections in London, and this is the least reform part of the country until you get to the Anglo-Scottish border. But, of course, therefore, again, looking underneath the bonnet, what we can do is to look at how well reform do in the places where they do stand, and is their vote up on where it was? And that will help to answer the question that, you know, all pollsters are asking about, how reliable is this? And also then also, is there any relationship between reform being on the ballot paper and how well or badly the Conservatives do? Again, these are questions beneath the headline stuff that we can do with the data we're collecting at the BBC. And then, of course, the Blackpool South by-election, which is Blackpool South, is a very Eurosceptic area. You know, it should be somewhere where reform could do reasonably well. Voter ID. I mean, to be honest, this is a bit of a polarised subject. If you think that maybe voter ID might be a good idea, you will point to the evidence of whatever it is that 0.x% of people who turned up to the polling station and were denied entrance originally, then didn't come back again. And it represents, what it is, 0.6% of the people who are going up. If, on the other hand, I don't like this policy, say, but some of them, an unknown number, which is quite conveniently unknown number, didn't go into the polling station because somebody had told them beforehand, but have you got your ID, right? So the debate continues. I must admit, my own views are somewhat coloured by having done election observation elsewhere, and basically not having a requirement to prove your identity does not mean we're not up to international standards. Okay, OECD will regard this as standard. And if when OECD is observing elections in place, they don't count anymore, observing things in Russia, one of the things absolutely looking at is, are people required to give their ID? What is the risk of fraud, et cetera, et cetera? Now, one of the reasons why we are where we are is because we have a very peculiar Victorian system of architecture, and we used to rely not on people being challenged on the polling station, but people being challenged to get on the register in the first place. And what the parties did was to challenge whether or not people had the right to vote as a part of the registration process. And, but of course, it's already the case in Northern Ireland where we felt we couldn't trust people. You do have to voter ID. To be honest, I mean, in terms of the level of turnout last year, you really couldn't tell the difference. I think, that said, what I think is unfortunate about it, I think in an ideal world, this would have been done on a bipartisan basis, and that all of the parties would come to an agreement about the introduction of this, and that along the way, shall we say, some seemingly curious decisions about was and was not valid ID would not be the source of contention. Now, insofar as ideally in a liberal democracy, you want agreement about the fundamental rules of the game. And I think the right of people to vote, in a sense, is part of the fundamental rules of the game. So I think this is unfortunate. So I think I'm not necessarily opposed to the principle, though, of course, it then really gets us to the whole argument about ID cards, because most people who require people to choose their identity have ID card systems. So, everybody has the ID that's required, so long as they can find it. So that makes it more complicated here. But that aside, I think in principle it's difficult to object to. The question is, could have it been implemented better, and can it still be implemented better in future?
Thanks, Sean. Sarah?
Yeah, just to add on that, I think, yeah, you're right, it wasn't as big a pressure last year as had perhaps been feared, but I think electoral administrators are still concerned what will happen in a general election when turnout will be so much higher. There's also this issue of it's kind of changed the nature of what you do as a polling clerk, mm-hmm. and that's making it a bit harder to recruit people to do that. So it's usually council staff that will give up their normal duties and do that for a day. But if you're having to sort of confront people and challenge people, there's less kind of willingness to do that. So that's another sort of slight concern with it. And it's not just voter ID that's been brought in. There's various other changes that that are coming in around sort of postal votes, and you know, have to show ID if you want to drop your postal vote off at a polling station, you then have to show ID for that where you didn't before. So there will be some sort of minimal issues, I think, as the system gets used to the new way of working. And yeah, I think, as John said, the way it was introduced, as even I think Jacob Rees-Mogg admitted, was, I think he used the term gerrymandering. So yeah, that's not a great start, is it, if we're trying to maintain trust in our... Mm-hmm.
But he's now, of course, concerned that maybe it's going to rebound on them because older voters are less likely to have the passport. It would be the easy form of ID.
Huh. Akash, I wanted to come to you on one of the online questions. So tomorrow, Merrill and Police and Crime Commissioners are being voted on by first past the post for the first time. Used to be supplementary vote. What difference are you expecting that change system to have on the elections?
So I think, you know, it's not likely to have make a difference to the result very often. I mean, we looked at this in a blog that we did. My colleague Millie, who's somewhere in the room, crunched the number, and I think we found, here, I've got it here, there were 223 elections held under the supplementary vote, so the system used up until this time, for Metro Mayor, PCC, and local authority mayoral elections, out of which 17 occasions, the result would have been different under first past the post, assuming people didn't change the way they voted. In other words, the person who got the highest share of first preference votes was not then the successful candidate because the second place person overtook them. So in other words, it will from time to time lead to different results. I mean, there was one Metro Mayor last time around, James Palmer in Cambridgeshire, who had the highest share of first preferences and lost on second preferences. So we might see that sometimes. And I mean, what we've concluded about this is the risk of this change is, I mean, what you might see sometimes is mayors elect, and I'm specifically talking about Metro mayors really here, elected with a pretty small share of the vote, maybe a third or so, particularly when there's lots of candidates. And in a system that, unlike SV or AV would as well, that where there's no kind of incentive for them or imperative for them to appeal for second preferences from people who back other candidates. And our concern about that is you might see people elected who are less able to basically do what it is that Metro mayors are there to do, which is work across party lines often, work with a wide set of stakeholders and build a coalition for, you know, whatever projects that they're trying to advance, because they don't have all the executive power, you know, to just do this stuff themselves. Their effectiveness in post is based, as we've already touched upon, on that mandate and that authority. And I think there is a risk with that change that in some circumstances that would be weakened. Mm-hmm. So in our view, it probably is something that a future government should revisit.
Thank you. We've also got a question on independent mayors. We've talked about Jamie Driscoll already. Sarah, are there other independent mayors you can see being elected tomorrow? And is there any benefit to having an independent mayor rather than a mayor that has a party machine behind them?
So we're talking about Metro mayors.
Metro mayors.
Yeah. I don't think there are any other independent mayors. There's a smattering of candidates, but I don't think we're going to get any independent mayors elected. The Jamie Driscoll situation is really interesting because obviously he was Labour until relatively recently. And, you know, there's the argument, isn't there, about how is it beneficial to have a mayor that's also that's for the same party that's in power, and if we're expecting that to be Labour probably some point soon, you know, how does that dynamic work given Jamie Driscoll's not only left Labour Party but fallen out pretty badly with them. But equally, you know, I think you can be a sort of a stronger voice for your region, potentially, if you're not kind of bound by party lines. But the question is anybody listening? I think that if you look at, you know, you look at Andy Street and Andy Burnham, they have not always towed the party line.
No.
And they're able to, you know, speak for their place and not speak for their for their party. So, I'm not sure it makes a massive difference.
Right, I'm going to come up back out to the room. I've got a hand straight up over here in purple. One here on the front row, and then here, glasses.
So we've talked about people like Andy Street distancing themselves from their party and having an independent, personal vote of their own. But what about, you know, generally, where, you know, you have the Conservatives changing their party name on all the ballot papers to Local Conservatives? Does it work? And if you've not, I think today in the, they have Swanage Conservatives literally writing out saying, you know, we are not National Conservatives, we are Local Conservatives. I mean, like, really, really desperate stuff. Does it work? And how can we judge whether it works?
Great, and then we've got one just here. Sorry, do you mind saying your name and where you're from, if possible?
Yeah, my name is Hamish, and I work at Stonehaven, which is a sort of political consultancy with its own polling arm as well. But I wanted to know what you thought about the effect of kind of the collapse of local media sources and local radio, local newspapers was on these elections, and also in kind of the accountability of local authorities as well, and whether it makes further devolution more risky.
Thank you. And then here.
So my question's related to that. I really wanted to ask Sarah, that it struck me that the campaign in London has been crucifyingly dull and low-key, and I wondered whether the contests anywhere else were capturing the public imagination in any sense, because it seems to be an incredibly sort of boring set of local elections, and the only leaflets I'm getting through my door, apart from the mayoral booklet, have all been about the general election. Even Labour haven't bothered to distribute anything talking about the mayoralty, or I'm in a highly marginal GLA seat, and nothing about that.
Thank you. So, Sarah, I'm going to come to you first. Are they more exciting elsewhere?
So, from what I've seen and picked up, I think... Yeah, the obvious ones, Tees Valley and West Midlands.
That's where the contest is.
There's been a lot of interest there. What I'm sort of speculating here, but what I don't get a sense is that any of the parties are spending lots of money on these elections. I don't know if they're all kind of hoarding their war chests for a general, presumably, but and yeah, in London, there's kind of no. The polling suggests there's not a big challenge from any of the other parties, so you would kind of assume that's driving that. But generally, to the question about local media, I think it is a massive concern. I started my career as a local journalist, and I think there's just no better like foundation for life, really. Like a few years on a local newspaper, you kind of see all sorts and everything. But I just don't think, you know, those opportunities aren't really there anymore, or if they are, they're not local often, they're miles away. And I think London really, as a major city, is quite underserved by its political media, really, in terms of some of the kind of the level of coverage and the depth of the analysis that we get from some of our local newspapers. So yeah, I'd agree it's a real concern.
John, does distancing yourself from the National Party work?
It's common practice when your party is in trouble, but I certainly have never aware of any evidence that it's particularly successful. Though whether anybody has ever done any systematic analysis, I'm not aware. But I presume that Mr. Sunak's face has not appeared on that many Conservative leaflets in the last 3 weeks. But Sir Keir Starmer's at least has probably been on some, although he's not particularly popular either, but
you can see
why people want to distance themselves. Sorry?
I have not found Keir Starmer on any of the
manifestos, but he's not very popular either. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've got, we do have a problem in this country at the moment. We don't really have any good politicians who are leaders of political parties. The S&P have finally ditched theirs. We'll see whether they can come up with somebody better this second time around, but anyway.
Akash, I wanted to, do you want to come in on any of those questions from the audience?
Only to say, I mean, on the media, local media question, I mean, yeah, I think generally this question of accountability of metro mayors is, it's a very important one. I think it's kind of well recognised that the local scrutiny model that exists for metro mayors is very weak.
Yeah.
The scrutiny committees they have of councillors, most of whom never show up, they don't get paid for it, they don't really see any point in doing it. Obviously in London, there's a London Assembly, which at least is something, even though people question how effective it is. But basically, I think when there is a weak or virtually absent local media with the capacity to kind of, you know, forensically follow what mayors are doing, how combined authorities are using money, that does leave a bit of an accountability gap. And that potentially, you know, incentivizes or encourages government departments to not let go naturally, because you know, if things go wrong, they'll feel that the buck stops there. So I think that is one reason why devolution, you know, maybe has been a bit slower than some of us might want it to be.
I also wanted to ask you, Akash, about the kind of the outlook for the future of devolution in England. We're going to have at some point a new government, whether that's a continuation of the incumbents or a Labour government. What are some of the kind of key questions facing them about the future of English devolution?
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, we've touched upon some of these already. I mean, one we haven't talked about, and yes, thank you for, again, opportunity to mention it, but we have a paper that we'll be talking about this coming out soon. So what one thing that both parties, in one form or another, have committed to is extending devolution to the rest of the country. So as of tomorrow, around about 50% of the population of England will be covered by some kind of devolution deal. There's a few more deals on track to be done by next year. But still, quite a lot of areas, including some big cities, big urban areas, have been left out. So I think one important question is, how do you complete the map, as it's sometimes called, of devolution, which we think is the right thing to do, first of all, just for fairness reasons, because it does, in you know, our analysis, bring benefits. Only seems right that all places should have that opportunity. But I also think it would be good for central government, because at the moment, you have this weird situation of government departments like DLUHC taking, in some parts of the country, kind of, you know, micromanage decisions about resource allocation, mm-hmm. about house building, DfT doing likewise for transport, et cetera, et cetera. And in other places, they've got a much more hands-off approach. It's quite weird, and I don't think it leads to good policy making and resource allocation, basically. And central government, I think, would benefit from being liberated from some of that stuff, so it can focus on the things that it actually does better in terms of, you know, big national strategic objectives, resource allocation, you know, making sure there's sort of fair distribution, accountability and governance questions at a high level, that kind of thing. For us, that's one key thing for the next government.
Thanks, Akash. And John, last question from the online audience for you. If the Conservatives do better than expected tomorrow,
yeah.
does that reduce the likelihood of the general election being held sooner rather than later?
I have long been of the view that the election will be on the 14th of November, and that the relative relative performance of the assuming the Conservative Party lose, right? Whether they lose narrowly or lose badly is irrelevant. It's for the person who has to make the decision, which is Rishi Sunak, right? I take the view, basically, if the Conservatives lose, his political career is over, he has no base in the party, and, you know, he might as well go back and make some more money in California or enjoy his swimming pool, because it will be his political career will be over, right? But what has he got? He's got, so long as he can stop his party trying to throw him out, he's got 2 years in the bank. by going to November. And in that, between now and November, he can aim to get the legislation on the statute book that might eventually get rid of tobacco smoking in the UK. And when the history books get written in 20 years' time, the one thing that Richard Sunak will be remembered for is for that legislation. And hey, guys, that's not bad. That's more than most prime ministers managed to achieve. But I think the all the arguments about how, well, maybe the Tories will lose a bit, little bit less here, then, or whatever, it's irrelevant to him, right? Unless all of a sudden the Conservative Party is in a position where he might be able to carry on in office, he has every incentive of just running the clock on, maximising his term in office, and at least enjoying the job while he's got it, because he probably doesn't have it thereafter.
On that note, going to bring the event to a close. I think we're bang on 5:30. Akash has already mentioned the fact that we've got a report out on the next steps for English devolution in 2 weeks' time?
2 weeks'
time. 2 weeks' time. So please do visit our website then and have a look for it, and to look at all our other fantastic work on devolution. Huge thanks to our brilliant panel for a fascinating, lively discussion. And huge thanks to the audience, both in person and online, for great questions. For those of you who are in person, do come out into the landing and join us for a drink. Thanks, everyone.